I think Indians should invest in India. Yes. Right now, India's on a roll.
Wow.
I mean, yes. Nobody wants to be left behind. We have some of the most successful multinational companies anywhere in the world. These same companies have not made this kind of money in China. I think as a woman, I always felt I was a bit of a goldfish in a bowl. Mm. That there were people out there who were just waiting for me to fail. Mm. To say, we told you, you know, I mean, women shouldn't be bankers. I mean, most of my career I've spent positioning India because I worked with foreign banks. And a lot of our work was trying to bring capital into India.
Hello and welcome. My name is Anupam Kher. Welcome to my show. In this turbulent and uncertain world of today, the focus now more than ever is on India, Bharat. Our guest today is the former country head of HSBC India and ex-president of the Federation of Indian Chambers of Commerce and Industry.
Naina Lal Kidwai is an Indian banker, chartered accountant, and business executive. She was not only the first Indian woman to get an MBA from Harvard Business School, but also the first woman to lead a foreign bank in India. She has served on various boards and has been involved in numerous roles as an advisor for the Indian government, including the Prime Minister's Trade and Industry Council. In 2013, she was awarded the Padma Shri, one of India's highest civilian honors, for her contributions to trade and industry. Naina is a strong advocate for gender diversity in the workplace and is deeply involved in philanthropic activities, particularly in the fields of healthcare and sanitation.
Welcome, Naina Lal Kidwai.
Thank you, and such an honor to be here with you today.
No, I'm so happy. I'm so happy that you have come. You come from a legacy family. What was it like growing up?
Well, I would love to say that I was fortunate to have very progressive parents, father and mother who delighted in the achievements of mine and my sister, who went on to become India's leading golfer and is still one of India's leading coaches in golf, and an Arjuna Awardee. And in my case, my sort of trajectory, much more into the world of finance, my father was CEO of an insurance company, so she took the golfing genes. He was an absolute golf fanatic, and I took his financial genes. And I think the lesson for a lot of us is how important fathers are in the shaping of us girls as we grow up. It's often just left to mothers, it's left to wider families, because fathers are busy out there working. But I put together a book, Anupam, called 30 Women in Power.
Okay.
Their voices, their stories. And almost with one voice, every one of these women achievers, the biggest influence in their life was their fathers.
But was he strict in his teachings unknowingly to you, or was he affectionate, loving? How was he?
A man of great integrity, very busy, affectionate, but not physically demonstrably so, but always there for me. And I had a lot of influences that were very North Indian in nature. So at every stage of my career, particularly when I wanted to go off to do an MBA at the Harvard Business School, uncles who were real detractors and sort of trying to influence my mother into, you know, she's just 22 years old, you're going to send her off to the US, you know, she'd never come back, she'd get married to a foreigner. And it was all of this nonsense. And I luckily had a father who understood my aspirations for myself, and a mother who didn't let any of this get in the way. And the good part of it is, because I had all these naysayers of how it was going to be a waste of money and time, that I was out to prove them wrong.
That they were wrong.
So it's helped sometimes to have those negative influences.
Oh, yes.
Because they can become big positives in life.
And you were the first woman to go to Harvard Business School. How was it being an Indian woman in the West in 1982?
Well, you know, I didn't go there knowing I was the first. 1 month into the school having started, I was summoned to the office and I thought, oh my God, those... What have I done? And they gave me a little check and they said, you're the first Indian woman. And, you know, the Harvard Business School is amazing. So that's how I learned about it. When I was there in the 80s, so this was 1982, 82, there was very little news in India. And forget, you know, there was no television those days. You relied on on newspapers. Mm. The only reporting on India was about famines and floods and poverty. And we were seen as a nation of snake charmers and elephants, not for what we are known today.
Yeah.
So a lot of energy and time on my part went into educating my classmates to what we are about. And the two cases that they used to be taught at the Harvard Business School were, and the 2.5 cases that they had at the time, were how Coke was chucked out of India and IBM had to leave India in the days when we, what we call were the FERA dilutions, the Foreign Exchange Regulation Act, where Indian companies, foreign companies were not allowed to hold more than 40%.
Mm.
So it was a very negative treatment and understanding of India, even at the business school. And today, that same business school has a research center in India.
Mm.
And opening cases in some of the important classes happen on Indian cases. I mean, most of my career I've spent positioning India because I worked with foreign banks, and a lot of our work was trying to bring capital into India. And it used to be an uphill story, trying to sell the India story, you know, 25, 30 years ago.
So what do you think the perception changed because of India changing, or they're becoming more educated about India?
Both. Certainly the latter two. And but we too became a lot, we were quite unfriendly to foreign capital till the big change in 1992 when India opened up.
Yes.
And with that opening came a marketing of India abroad, the desire to bring capital into India, both in terms of what we call foreign institutional investors into our capital markets, but also the foreign direct investment, companies being actually invited to come in. And with that change, I think we've been able to ensure that those that have come have made good money, have stayed here. We have some of the most successful multinational companies anywhere in the world. These same companies have not made this kind of money in China. I mean, look at the success stories in companies like Unilever in India, Hindustan Divas, and the scale of the Indian operation, which is, you know, easily a quarter of what they do globally.
Yeah.
Or even banks like I worked with, where India was amongst the top five, even when I was CEO of the bank, top five in the HSBC system in terms of profit and performance. And equally, today now, maybe rising to be amongst the top three. So the subsidiaries that are India in successful MNCs are very important subsidiaries of the multinational companies. And these success stories are watched by others who say, well, if they can do it, so can we.
Right.
And so you get more and more of the excitement to come in and invest in our story. And right now, India's on a roll.
Wow.
I mean,
yes,
nobody wants to be left behind. We are really at a beautiful point in our history, which we must grab with both hands.
I totally agree with you. But you went into banking. How chauvinistic was the environment when you started?
Well, you know, I have to say that I can't feel that I was discriminated in any way. I think the business school degree helped because it was sort of a chop of credibility.
Of course.
I was also fortunate to be working in investment banking where you kind of sink or swim based on the deals you do. It's very obvious if you succeed or you don't. So it was hard for bosses to dispute what you had done because it was your deal and nobody else could really claim credit for it. So I think both these factors helped me. If at all, there was sort of strain, which was much more of an India in the corporate world that was very hierarchical and that tend to go more to age. So I feel being young was really more of a challenge and trying to move it into what was a meritocracy to get rewarded for what one did, not for the age that you spent in the company, was probably more of a challenge than the gender thing.
So what was your driving force? What was it that was making you go for it?
I just felt every time I met other people and who were successful and good, there were many lessons to learn. And I would often think, well, if he or she could do it, and it was more he's than she's, then why not I? What does it take to be there? The big driving force, of course, often was the naysayers, the people who would say, oh, I mean, you know, she's a woman, so she's a lightweight, or the uncles who had said in the past that education is a waste of energy and time, she should just get her married. So it's the naysayers at every stage that I guess I was always a bit competitive. I played a lot of sports. I was out there to...
Which was your favorite sport?
Well, I played basketball for the school, for the state. I played badminton for the school, state. So yeah, so primarily those two games. But then one gave, I gave them up soon after college. But the competitiveness of knowing what it feels like to win and lose stayed with me. And I think that drove it too, that it was always a little bit of, I can get there if I want to, if I work hard. And there was always encouragement at the home front to help me drive myself into directions that I felt were important for me.
So how did you deal with failures in the early stages of your life?
Very badly. Yeah. Very badly, because if you're as driven or you're very insecure and unsure of yourself as a young person, you may not show it, but you just are. And every failure feels like this is the collapse, this is doomsday. And I think as a woman, I always felt I was a bit of a goldfish in a bowl, that there were people out there who were just waiting for me to fail, to say, we told you, you know, I mean, women shouldn't be bankers. So you felt that you sort of let down all of womankind, not just yourself. And that put a hell of a lot of strain on one's... I feel if I hadn't had that, I might have had a little more fun than I had.
Right.
I took myself too seriously in the process. But I think at the end of the day, I learned. Again, my father was a big part of an influence to really help me understand that failure was always a lesson going forward. It was only a failure if I didn't learn what the lesson was. And some of the most interesting turning points in my career were points where, which looked like failure, but when I look back, actually shaped what was a very important next decade for myself.
How has the banking and corporate industry in India changed over the past few decades?
Oh my God. I mean, look, when I entered the industry, we made our fortunes on ferrodilutions, which was companies diluting their shares in India and going out. And today, it's absolutely the reverse, where we want companies to come into India. When I started my career, we did not have two stock exchanges. The Bombay Stock Exchange was refusing to change with the times. So a group of us had initiated the idea of setting up a new stock exchange. And hence you saw the NSE come up. Because we just could not get the old to change. So the NSE came in and soon overtook the Bombay Stock Exchange. And that forced the Bombay Stock Exchange to change. We had stocks, shares, certificates, which were piled up in vaults. You couldn't move for miles because of the paper there. To what was then the whole Stock Exchange Corporation of India, where we had to, every certificate had to actually move into digital mode. And we had a lot of scams as a result, because there were duplicate certificates floating around. Oh, there was so much that was different. But we were able to bring a lot of change. Deals with difficulty that we were doing for 100 crores, and today, you'll hear of 20,000 crores from an LIC, which the market has so readily absorbed. So the scale of what we are able to absorb today and absorb within India, because people like you and me are putting our money into the stock markets and putting it into mutual funds. And these funds are now buying these shares, which otherwise we used to wait for foreign capital to buy.
True.
I remember that when we were looking to do a 100-year bond for Reliance Industries when I was at Morgan Stanley. And no other firm had done this in India. And we struggled to make sure that it could get off the ground. And only Reliance could really do it. And it did. But from there to where we are today, in terms of the debt issuance that's happening in the market, so it's not just an equity story. Of course, we need to do more. But the success of our capital markets, the scale of our banks, ICICI, HDFC, these banks today did not exist as banks when I started my career. ICICI was a project finance institution.
Where did you put your money in? Which bank did you?
In terms of equity?
Yeah.
You know, because I worked for a bank, we didn't invest in stocks. So my principle always was no conflict. So I only ever invested in mutual funds. I didn't trade on the stock markets.
And What do you think are the advantages of India's finance sector today?
The advantages? Huh? I think the biggest advantage derives from the high savings rate of our country. Mm. But also from the fact that we now have world-class large banks. Mm. And this is particularly true of the private sector banks, the strength of the ICICIs, HDFCs, Axis, Kotak Mahindras, these banks coming through the system. Also, the scale of our State Bank of India and the public sector banks. If at all I have some hesitation in saying that it is absolutely the ideal banking system, it is that we have still three quarters of our banking system is with public sector banks. Oh. And I would certainly like to see some of that shareholder sort of dilute down, either through what was being promised as some privatization or through the growth of the private sector. It doesn't have to be through shrinkage on one side. It can be through growth on the other, so that we get a little more balance into the system. But the strength of our banks today, the low not performing assets, all are in very good shape.
So next question is very important for me personally. What should Indians invest in today to be rich tomorrow?
Yeah. Well, I think Indians should invest in India.
Of course.
This is not about investing abroad. And there is fortunately limited money, but it does go abroad. I think for each of us, it is at one level, of course, if I can go away from financial markets, it's education, it's our culture, it's art, it's everything that is the soft side of India, which actually is so powerful in a global context. I mean, India is known for Bollywood. Before we were known for anything we were doing in the financial markets, quite honestly.
Yes.
I mean, even in China, Russia, you name these countries. India was known for the films it was making, for our art, for
our music.
But
it was not becoming our soft power. Means we were known that, for them, like snake charmers and elephants, they thought that Indian cinema is only about dancing around
and
the trees and things
sadly,
like that.
Yeah.
Which is, and for what excited them about India was its poverty in cinema.
Yeah.
Or its, you know, its
like
backwardness
the,
or something like
the,
that.
The early Satyajit Ray's and
They were classics, they were amazing. But I feel that the cinema of India represented outside should be cinema India of today.
Yeah. And our program, and I think some of that is coming through.
It is. It is coming through. Yes.
A lot more thoughtful, and it's so important because it is a portrayal of what India is today.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think if we can continue to invest in our,
but the question was, what should Indians invest in today to be rich tomorrow?
Yeah. So I think real estate, because we will always see land in short supply and just the sheer pressure of population, but we have to have, I think, a balanced portfolio. So the ideal would be, you know, maybe a third in real estate, a third in debt instruments, a third in equity, and a little bit in maybe the commodity markets like gold, etc. So you end up with this balanced portfolio. And I would say best to do it through mutual funds. And that's what's really happening. People are investing through SIPs. And that wall of money is helping India, because even when global capital went out, this is the first time in our history that when global capital markets reacted with money leaving India, we did not see our stock markets dip. Because we had enough of domestic savings coming through these SIPs and the buying that is happening into our mutual funds. So our mutual funds filled the gap. They saw it as an opportunity to buy as share prices fell. And this is what we call a mature market. It's domestic saving, domestic money, which is there helping prop up our markets. We are not over-dependent on foreign capital anymore.
How much is the role of the government in doing that?
I would like to say it's really the role of companies, right?
Okay.
Our companies have to do well for stock markets to go up. Government can shout from a rooftop, but if our companies don't do well, stock markets won't go up. But government creates an ecosystem for the companies to do well.
Right.
Government has to create an ecosystem where its regulations don't keep chopping and changing, which makes it hard for, on the one hand, the corporate sector to keep up, but also for investors to have to understand their tax and the payments. And we did a lot of chopping and changing, which put off foreign capital because they just couldn't understand our taxes beyond a point. And there was too much litigation around tax, which made a lot of foreign capital unhappy. And we do have some dependency on private equity, which is money that comes in large chunks into our companies in India. And we do need foreign institutional investors investing here. And we have to say goodbye to regimes like Vodafone and the kind of tax mess we got ourselves into with retrospective taxation. And it was a horrible reputation we created for ourselves with the fact that we could come in with retrospective tax. So these were hard lessons and lessons well learnt by us, and which I'm sure we will not repeat as India. So government's role has to be about fairness, justice, quick resolution of problems, lending a year to things that are not happening, being able to solve for that, making sure that they play a very fair system, that we don't create an uneven playing field for in favor of some vis-a-vis others. And then you let corporates just do what they do best, which is they run their companies. They make sure that they create wealth. They make sure that they're good community-spirited corporates. And if they don't do it right, you wallop them. Yeah, you make sure that they get fined, that they get sorted through. And therein the justice system has to play a role. So what government invests in our institutions are what will be the strength of India tomorrow.
Wonderful. So how important is the Corporate Social Responsibility Initiative, the CSR?
So very important. I think when CSR first came in, the debate...
How did it come in?
It came in as legislation. Okay. Having said that, there was a rich tradition of Indian companies in giving. Groups like Tata's, Birla's, Mahindra's. Yes. They have, for very long, even without a regulation, you know, been givers into society. What did change was when it became a regulation that those that weren't in there had to now part with 2% of their profits into areas that were important in terms of community and community development. I think it gave a whole new focus to the way companies saw themselves. And many companies initially just wrote checks to NGOs. Then they began to feel, well, we should do more. So the engagement of companies in actually monitoring and working down at the grassroots began to change. And in fact, one of the areas I'm working in now, which is in sanitation, with the Ministry of Drinking Water and Sanitation through the India Sanitation Coalition, which is an NGO which I started. And what we are doing there is with the corporate sector, going in and adopting model villages down at the grassroots, where the government has said, we don't need your money. They've told the corporates, we don't need your money. We have enough money sitting in the system to help these villages become model villages. We want you in the corporate sector to adopt these villages to make sure that we can tick all the boxes of what goes into a model village, and that if you can just make sure that execution happens. We've had the first 10 corporates come forward in this program. They've adopted these villages to make sure that they become model villages. And the next phase of the program, we have another 50 corporates coming in saying, hey, we like the success of what we've seen. This is a true public-private partnership. We would love to play a role to help government spend its money in sanitation and water in the villages that we work in, or the villages that surround our factories, or the villages that are important to us. And so it's a national program. And I think this is what we want, that every citizen, every corporate takes the responsibility to make sure that money that needs to be spent in particular ways, and that money that's sitting there and not getting spent, gets spent.
So tell us about the India Sanitation Coalition and the impact it has had.
So my work is really sanitation, water. It impacts women in a very big way. As you can imagine, water is such an important subject for women. But the area we work in is really more to do with bringing what was initially the Swachh Bharat Mission's program. And I started the India Sanitation Coalition just 6 months before the Prime Minister announced the Swachh Bharat Mission. So just pure luck. Wow. And we moved from behavior change and toilet building. So you build toilets, make sure people use them. You get them to make the toilets. But now it's a lot about treatment, that what goes into the toilet needs to be treated, otherwise goes right back into the field, right back into our water bodies, right back into our rivers, untreated, and it's the same mess. You might as well let people mess it up in the first place.
Yes.
So the treatment side of it is very important, and the government has a huge program on that through Namami Ganga along the Ganges, but also at each village level, how we treat the waste that comes from the toilet. How do we recover water, which is called the wastewater recovery program. And now plastic waste management. I mean, there's plastic everywhere. It's also a resource. Mm. It's something that if we can garner, it can be reused. It can be used for fuel. It can be used for recycling. It can be used in methods which we have yet to discover. Mm. But what do? We chuck it everywhere rather than collect it in a way that it can be reused. So this journey for India is going to be a very important one on how we recover and recycle waste. Mm. Everything, whether it's sewage, whether it's water, whether it's plastic, so that we can really have a clean, hygienic India, one where we aren't falling sick all the time, and where women benefit in particular, because they are the caregivers, they are the ones who have to stay at home, look after the sick children, they are the ones who have to fetch water for miles, and at the end of the day, just be proud of the nation we have, because it would be a clean and green India.
So apart from your father, who has been your role models or mentors, if I may ask you?
Oh, so many. Mm-hmm. So many. Because through life, one doesn't just learn from one person.
Yes.
It's every person one comes into contact with. I mean, I learned from my executive assistant, who at the height of the riots in Bombay, when we were all being advised not to come to office, and I was in a senior role, I had to walk half the way, got to office to find that my executive assistant's there, and she'd come from Bandra, for, Bombay, all the way down to the Fort area, leaving a three-year-old child with a neighbor. And I was like, what on earth are you doing here? But the need that she felt was, hey, I thought you would be here and you would need me. Mm. I mean, I was like this. She had every excuse not to come, but she's here. And people like her.
But then I think it's an individual who brings out that loyalty in the other person also.
I think people just, they're...
I'm sure. Yeah. But I don't think it's one-way traffic. Yeah. Well, if she had a horrible boss, she would have not done that.
Well, I don't know.
I would like to think like that
if
also.
If it was a horrible boss, she may have come out of fear.
That's right.
But so one learns, right? Mm. Then I was like, who am I to even think twice about what am I trying to do coming to office? I mean, I came in track pants. I came with my sneakers. So if I had to run back home, I was going to get back. And wondering why I'm doing this. Mm. I mean, look at the lesson she said. So I think we take lessons every day from the Ila Bhats of the world and what they do at Seva. And you go, you learn, you see, and you come back with such important parts of what you want to be. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think mentors at many, many
have been changing. Yeah. Thank you, Nanda Lal Kidwai. Thank you so much, and thank you for watching. And join me next week for another gripping conversation, and let's talk Bharat. Namaste.